What's up, another episode of Ripple Effect? Fuck, I messed up on my own intro. What's up, another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast? I'm your host, Ricardo Varenas, also known as Ricky Varenas. And today we have a great episode for you. Another non-controversial conversation about cancer and vaccines. I'm kidding. One thing I love about this podcast is that I can dive deep into these topics regardless if people consider them controversial or not. I think people like my guest today, Dr. Thomas Cowan, who helped you realize how unscientific science is, and even James Corbett has a great podcast he did recently, a little short documentary called The Crisis of Science, that goes into how many scientific studies can't be recreated and all that stuff. It really, you realize that, like, wow, science isn't that scientific after all. And or it does require some believing and faith in that this explanation is what it is. But yeah, so Dr. Thomas Cowan's a great guest. I love these type of conversations with on diet and nutrition, because I think these are conversations that could help people today or in the near future. It's hard to enjoy life when you're depressed or you don't have energy or you're in pain. And when I do shows like today where we talk about diet, nutrition, medicine, and you know, he has a couple of really good books, a bunch of really good books, which you can find on Amazon. I'll put in the show description on our YouTube channel. One is Cancer, The New Biology of Water, another one on vaccine, another one on the human heart. It's fascinating and it's important. And, you know, I've had people on like Dr. Dominic DiAgostino and Dr. Thomas Seyfried, which we talk about a little bit on the show today. And Dr. Brzezinski has been on in the past, and so many of Dr. Gregory A. Smith, and even my show I did with Chris Bell on Kratom and the keto diet. To me, these are some of my most important podcasts, because I know there's people listening who can get something from it. If you're dealing with chronic pain, if you're dealing with, you know, just a lack of energy, your mood sucks, whatever it may be, it's really important that I'm sharing discussions that could change people's lives. And, you know, you by changing the way you eat, by changing your lifestyle, maybe meditating, maybe trying to remove stress, maybe you realize that you've been lied to about what we should be eating, if it's cholesterol, if it's sodium, if it's all these things that the food industry and the FDA and the government and all this stuff has been telling you that, hey, you know, cholesterol causes this, or sodium is bad for you, you know, when it's really a essential mineral. You know, we've been sold a book of lies. So it's important to be able to kind of cut through that BS and have these people on who are willing to push back and go against the grain and help all of us be healthier and happier. And now I sound like Wim Hof, because that's what he always says, you know, trying to help people become healthier and happier. And he's another one who pushes against the grain and makes you rethink what the human body is capable of and alternative ways of becoming healthier and happier and fighting disease. So all this stuff, like I said, is super important. And all this stuff is stuff that I practice in my everyday life. So, but yeah, so thanks everybody for tuning in. This is episode 201, which it still boggles my mind that like 6 years ago, I started this podcast, and 200 plus episodes later, I'm still doing this, and I'm happy. And in a way, it's for selfish reasons, because I have a reason to contact people that I'm a fan of and have a reason to get them to sit down and talk to me for a significant amount of time. But also, I really do feel like we're all a part of creating this change. And like Sam Tripoli said, or has said many times, the revolution will be podcasted. And I believe that maybe if it's not podcasted, it's definitely going to be it's sparking a lot of different little revolutions in the way we think, in the way we look at the world. So, and we're all doing our part and sharing the podcast. If you can't support podcasts via Patreon, if you can share the podcast and just, you know, share these discussions or just talk to people about them, I think we're all doing our part in starting a ripple that could really make some bigger change in the near future. So thanks again, guys. And I'll see you on the next one. Peace. I believe in the ripple effect.
how did I get into this? good question. All I can say is, I tell people, I grew up like knowing that I'm supposed to be a doctor because a lot of my parents' friends were doctors, and I was good in school and good in science, and so everybody, it was like obvious I was going to be a doctor, and I wanted no part of it. I just there was something about it that made me think these guys don't know what they're talking about, and there was no way I could have articulated anything about what I meant. I just had that sense. So I go to college, didn't really like it, but I did well because I know how to do that. So then I joined the Peace Corps to teach gardening in Swaziland, just because I'm trying to look for something else to do with myself. And there in Swaziland, I get given the books by Rudolf Steiner and Weston Price, which I often say I'm probably the only person I know of who learned about anthroposophy and Rudolf Steiner and Weston Price in a mud hut in Swaziland. Maybe there's somebody else out there, but I doubt it. And it hit me then that the doctor that I didn't want to be was not the only kind of doctor there was. And that was a revelation in my life, because at that point, it was like a dam burst. And so I wasn't interested in it before. I mean, a little bit, you know, food or something. But then I saw, and I'm around 20 at the time, that there's a whole nother world out there, and it's like all about food and this whole history of humanity, and I want to know about this. And so now it's, you know, 45 years later, and I pretty much have been studying it almost every day since. And so then I decided, well, okay, I know what kind of doctor I want to be, and arrogantly thought, because I know this, I'm going to be able to, like, cure everybody of everything and transform the way we do medicine in this country. I mean, you know, I didn't know anything really, but that's what I thought, sort of. And so I can go to medical school, and I just won't say anything about what I think. And that's what I did. So I got my degree, got my license, you know, did the residency and everything. And all this time, I'm trying to figure out how to do the kind of medicine that I want to do. I, of course, realized along the way that it's a lot more complicated than I had given it credit for, but so be it. So then and that's basically been 40 years of trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've learned from your interviews is that you're definitely very into researching, and I think that's awesome, because you're keeping up with constant. I mean, that's the thing about a lot of these people who become doctors or pediatricians, is that they kind of are just preaching the same stuff they were taught that could be 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, and aren't really quite up to date with maybe the newest research. And is that a common theme issue that you see?
You know, I wouldn't say that. I don't think I'm more up to date on current research than anybody else. I just think I'm interested in different research or different information than most doctors. You know, they're interested in what the, you know, Journal of the AMA says, and I don't remember the last time I even set eyes on one. I'm sure I've read articles from there at various times, but you know, I follow my nose and my heart about what I want to learn about next. And now, because I've written all these books, people send me stuff. Well, you're talking about, you know, the new biology of cancer, and so here's I get in the last week, like, you know, documents and proofs that the water that surrounds the DNA actually determines how the DNA is expressed. And then I get, you know, information about how in studies and pictures and whole documents about if you water a pea plant with tap water, it does like this. And if you water it with water that's been vortexed and structured, it does a whole lot better. And if you put water next to a child wireless monitor, you know, one of those baby monitors, you practically kill the pea plant. So, and I now am in an enviable position where I can mostly just get information from people who are now hoping that I'm interested in what they're doing. So it's made my life a lot easier, which is so, and that's kind of what I rely on. I have a kind of a fundamental trust that, because there's been so many times in my life that I've been given a kind of gift that I didn't really earn or deserve, that has pushed me in a direction that I was not expecting to go. Like one of the examples was in my early years of being a doctor, I was sent a manuscript from William Coley, who is the founder of Coley's Toxins, which was basically a fever therapy for cancer. And out of nowhere, I'm sent this, you know, 1,000-page document of every case that Coley treated at Kettering Memorial Hospital. Like, I don't know why this person sent it to me. Like, this person is his daughter. She decides to send me this, so I spend the next 6 months. I didn't even know there was no other documents like that around. I mean, I didn't know anything about it. Like, why'd you send this to me? But anyways, I got it. So I read, you know, 5,000 cases, or I don't know how many, of the people that this guy treated by inducing fevers. And at the end of that, I said to myself, well, I guess Hippocrates is right. You know, give me a medicine to produce a fever and I can cure any disease. And I need to know how that works. And again, that was just a sort of gift. Like, I didn't do anything to, you know, merit that, or I didn't know this woman. I didn't ask her for it. And so somehow I've learned to trust that process. I don't know if this makes any sense to you, but I've learned to trust the process that if I'm honest, diligent, and really take this seriously, this work that I'm doing, this, for lack of a better word, the spiritual world will give me the help that I need. That's the only way I can say it.
Yeah, I mean, it does make sense. I think what you're doing is, I mean, there's a need for people like you, because I think science has become the new religion. And I'm not, you know, the first one to say that, but because you have to have faith similar to religion to just basically not question it, just agree that, hey, we haven't figured it. We figured it out. Don't question it. And we're the scientists. We're the higher power. We have truth with a capital T. So just believe what we're saying. And I think that's a huge issue, because, I mean, nothing's less scientific than saying that you haven't figured out. I mean, you might understand it to some extent, but, I mean, science is constantly changing, as, you know, you new experiments show you a different outcome, and how many experiments can't be recreated. You know, things like the placebo effect, which we don't understand. We know it exists, but we don't understand. I mean, there's just constant examples of it. And so we need people like, you know, I'm a fan of Gary Tobbs, because Gary Tobbs was the same way. He was somebody who kind of made people rethink science, and that we should just put all this faith in science, that, oh yeah, science proves this. And then we just go along with our day saying, oh yeah, it's figured out. We figured it out. See, it's there's no, you know, the science is settled. And I think in the human body is so complicated, the world's so complicated, that you can't just put faith in it. And but I have,
well, yeah. The way my comment on that, you know, we all have our favorite sayings. One of mine is, the problem with science is it's not very scientific. And what I mean by that is, if you look up the definition of science, it says the belief that only things that can be measured and quantified actually exist, or something like that. It's like a paraphrase.
Yeah,
and therein lies the key. And so what I mean by that is, as I often say, I'd love to see a double-blind study showing that only substance exists. Like, what about love? Or what about I feel bad? Like, where is the substance of feeling bad? But The reality is we have a science, so-called science, and a so-called study of biology and a system of medicine, which, believe it or not, and people are often, you know, they don't really believe me when I say this, but it absolutely is true. We study the human being as if it's only made of substance. And the analogy that I would give for that, it's like somebody decides they want to understand the Mona Lisa, right? That famous Da Vinci painting.
Yep.
Okay, so that's important because it's one of the most important paintings ever painted. But the rule of it is you're only allowed to study the substance of the paint and the canvas. So you do this investigation, you find out that the paint is this made of this, and the canvas has this many threads, etc. But you're never allowed to say, I wonder why Da Vinci painted this, or why he even chose this color, or why he put the smile this way, right? It's nonsense, because everything that's important about that painting was in the mind and heart of Da Vinci. Now, it is true that he used colors, and I think he was even interested in color and which made the best yellow or something. But that's not where the interest, that's not where the action is in the painting. Or it's also like studying a house and saying you're only allowed to say about the bricks, as if the bricks formed themselves into a house, which of course is nonsense. Everything that's important about a house is in the mind and consciousness of the architect, right? I mean, that's the reality. And if you apply that to the human being, we study the substance of the human being as if that's the only thing that matters. We're actually, in medicine, not allowed to say anything about any other aspect. There's no other forces or energies or anything involved. Somehow this substance just came together, and by some miracle or unknown process, even can think about whether it's like a real or not. And people say, well, I don't believe that. And I say, well, who's the I that doesn't believe that there's more to life than just substance?
Yeah,
well, that's an artifact of my brain. Like, my brain secreted this thought that I must not be here. Like, I mean, we're talking nonsense now.
Yeah, I mean, it's so much, and I'm constantly, that's why I say no theory. When I hear about some doctor who cured something or whatnot, nothing to me seems too outrageous to at least explore, because I've been wrong so many times. Even like I've used in the past, you know, we'll be talking about the problems with the modern medicine and just the medical system in general. And I'd say it's symptom management. And I've heard you kind of describe it in a way where I'm like, okay, now I don't think I can use that term anymore, because the things that we call symptoms, after you kind of explained it, it makes perfect sense. It's not really symptoms per se. It's more about your body trying to heal itself and fix itself, right?
Right. I mean, that's another one of my sayings, is the job of a doctor should be to distinguish between the therapy and the disease and not mistake the one for the other. And again, here's what I mean by that. So you get a splinter in your finger and you don't take it out. And the next thing you know that happens is you get pus. You get pus. Now, in medical school, you learn pus means an infection, means bad, means kill it. So you study that whole process by the type of bacteria that are living, and then you do sensitivities and see which antibiotic will kill it. The problem with that whole thing is the pus is the therapy for the splinter. How do I know that? Because if you leave the pus alone, it'll get the splinter out, and then the whole thing will be done. And if you stop the pus by whatever means, antibiotics or whatever, the splinter will stay, and it'll just happen over and over again. The splinter is the disease. The pus is the therapy. Now, it is true that the pus could eat your finger and then you'd have trouble, and I would give somebody an antibiotic then. But I'm not like doing it because I've like I'm not particularly doing them any favors. I mean, in a way I am because I stopped them from losing their finger. But the reality is that almost never happens. And that's a stupid example, which is why I use it. But another one is you smoke. So smoking is like putting splinters in your lungs. So what happens is you get bronchitis to get the splinters out of your lungs. And then you go to the doctor and he's mistaken, or she, and he or she says, oh, you have bronchitis, we need to give you an antibiotic. So he does, and then it goes away. And then that happens twice a year for 20 years, and then you've got lung cancer. So what is lung cancer? Lung cancer is a bag of splinters in your lungs irritating your tissue. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's close enough. So how did that happen? Well, A, because you put a bunch of splinters in your lungs, and B, some mistaken person stopped you from getting it out. And that's the problem with not knowing how the human being works. You make really bad mistakes for people, and then they get sicker. The way that the human being evolves to essentially is to use fever and mucus and pus and infectious disease, so-called acute illness, to remodel their physical body so that it becomes a better instrument for them. If you stop that process, I can 100% predict what's going to happen is you'll end up with a whole lot more sick people. And that essentially is modern medicine. That's what we did.
Yeah, I mean, you even look at like cancer, for example. I mean, I have friends and my mother-in-law and so many people who've been touched by cancer, and I see the common theme over and over again of they have cancer. They don't look that bad. They don't look that unhealthy, but they have cancer. They have to do something about it, so they put a bunch of chemicals in them that can cause cancer and weaken your immune system. They give you radiation, which, you know, is carcinogenic and can cause cancer. And it's like all these like just really what seem like primitive ways and unscientific ways of dealing with it. And then, you know, they don't tell you anything about maybe changing your diet, changing your lifestyle. I mean, not that changing your diet is going to cure yourself as cancer. In all cases, or if in any case, because I'm not a doctor, I don't want to give medical advice per se, but I definitely think that we do know that obviously glucose is an energy source of cancer. Obviously, changing your diet and maybe removing some glucose from your diet could help. There's even some research in benefits of fasting and all these alternative things that could help. You know, what are you going to do to help your immune system get stronger? You know, nobody asks that question while you're going through all this. So it all seems just completely insane. But we have this idea that if this person has a diploma on the wall and they're a doctor, then they must know the best options, best solutions, and I should take their advice. And I guess this goes back to what I was saying before, how it's become kind of almost like a religious thing where it's like, you know, they have the answers. I can't question it. And what do you tell somebody who listens to these alternative views, alternative methods of possibly healing using diet, nutrition, you know, lifestyle changes, and they say, hey, you know, if this worked, why isn't this being suggested to me by my doctor?
I mean, so there's to try to understand the question. I mean, first of all, there's a lot of different so-called alternatives and options. And, you know, I just wrote a book and published a book about cancer with a very specific description of how the whole process comes about. And out of that, then what one could or should do about it. So, you know, I have my own ideas on essentially what the cancer process is. And out of that, it becomes sort of obvious, you know, what one could do about it. So I don't remember exactly your question, but it is interesting that, like I describe in the book, the research on deuterium-depleted water, which is a kind of water that has has had the deuterium part removed, and the so it has more hydrogen. I don't want to get into what exactly that is right now. But anyway, the point of it is, I showed him research published in journals like the Journal of Urology. So this is very conventional urological journal showing that people with prostate cancer who do conventional therapy at a certain stage live for, I don't remember the exact numbers, but something, the reference is in the book. So something, let's just say 18 months. So you have stage whatever, 3 prostate cancer, you go to urologist, you do the normal treatment, and on average you live 18 months. Same group, you know, another group, same disease, same stage, same age, same everything, close as we can. They do conventional therapy plus deuterium depleted water, and they live 36 months. That's just a fact, and they report it, and they show you the data and everything. And there was 3 other studies, one with breast cancer and one with lung cancer. And then there was cases I showed them of 4 people with lung cancer who had metastases to their brain, and they showed the x-rays and the CT scans, and all they did was a treatment with deuterium depleted water. 18 months later, scans were clear and they were seemingly asymptomatic. So I go to this researcher, you know, cancer researcher, big university in the Bay Area, because somebody had introduced us and who was funding something and wanted to know if they would fund research into this with my help. So the guy looks at it and he says, so what's the explanation of how this water would help or cure people with cancer? And so I gave him a very short rendition of what where I thought the cancer process came from and why this would make sense. And he said, is there any published data on what you said? And I said, no, because nobody has, I mean, this may sound a little arrogant, but nobody has figured it out in this way. So the mechanism was mine. Let's just say it like that. But I said to him, but whether the mechanism that I said is right or wrong, and I'm not saying it's right. I think it's right. That's why I wrote it. But let's say that even the mechanism is wrong that I just of explaining why this water worked. The fact of the matter is, the water worked. And so whether I have the mechanism right or not, why don't you look into this? Because he said, well, because this is not the recognized mechanism of how cancer comes about. I said, so either the recognized mechanism is wrong or is certainly incomplete, but what difference does that make? The fact of the matter is, clear scientific so-called information, the type that you believe, tells you that this works. Why isn't it your responsibility then to figure out the mechanism? Well, because there's no published data on the mechanism. I said, right, what difference does that make? And at that point, we came to an impasse. And so he refused to have anything to do with it because there was no mechanism that he understood that could explain why this worked. In a sense, therefore, it didn't work. And the whole thing, when you think of it like that, it's crazy. What human being would think like that? The answer is, the entire establishment thinks like that.
Yeah, that's it's a similar issue when I had a Dr. Thomas Seyfried on who wrote Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. He, same thing. He, the lack of, I mean, first of all, he says himself, this isn't a new idea. This is a, you know, an old idea. But yet there's just no interest in it. There's nobody wants to look into it. Nobody wants to fund studies. Nobody wants to, you know, and it's like if there's, and I've been doing the ketogenic diet for years, and I know all the work that Charlie Foundation does, and Dr. Thomas Seyfried's work. I mean, there's benefits to changing your diet. I mean, that is pretty obvious, and yet, you know, everybody, you go to a doctor and they just give you the same typical dietary guidelines they've been giving for centuries. And they don't really they don't really know much about this other stuff. But I mean, this idea that only something prescribed by a doctor can be medicine, to me, is a huge issue. And I get to go back to my question I was asking. I guess what I was kind of beating around the bush about was, there's, you go to a doctor, and like, if I suggest your book, or I suggest, you know, somebody, you know, Dr. Thomas Seyfried's book, because of the doctor that they go to that's at the big hospital or whatever, isn't suggesting doing these same things, people dismiss it. And they dismiss it because, similar to the doctor you were referring to, because if it's not published, if it's not, you know, then it's not accepted. And I think that's a huge issue. I mean, I think there's a lot of quacks out there, and there's a lot of people who can tell you, hey, you know, this specific seed could cure you of this or cure you of that. But that doesn't mean that you dismiss it all. And I think there's a problem when people only go to their doctor at that hospital for information, because we live in a great time where we have the internet, and you can do so much research by yourself, and you can look at almost all the same studies and research the doctors, you know, has looked at. So, I think that's a huge problem.
Yeah, I mean, but some people have to learn the hard way. So be it. You know, you can't force anybody to do anything. And if they want to do that, I mean, that should be their right and privilege, and they see what happens.
Yeah, but it does go against everything that what you believe a doctor's goal and basically their purpose is to heal people and help people. And it's like, when there's information out there that could do that, and it's not being suggested, to me, it's a huge problem. You know, my parents, I mean, I was born in Portugal. I came here when I was young, but my parents still put doctors on this, you know, on this pedestal where, like, they're all knowing, you know, they're the, you know, if they suggested it, it's because that's what I should do. And if I suggest something, then they'll just dismiss it because I don't have the diploma. I don't have, you know, so it is one of those things where it's hard to help people sometimes, because even when you try to give them information, you try to, they're stuck in that issue. I mean, vaccines are another issue that there's never been a safety test. There's all this, you know, it hasn't really been proven to be safe or effective. And, but yet, you know, propaganda of media has done a great job of just saying that your kid's in danger if there's unvaccinated kids, which doesn't make any sense, because if your kid's vaccinated and you believe it works, your kid's not in danger. But do you get into all these what are considered controversial issues? Do you ever get any backlash, or because you come from it from a very scientific background, do you think, and even the way when you explain your perspective and your opinions on these things, it's very scientific. Do you think that helps compared to, because for me, it seems like the way you explain your views and your perspectives in a very scientific manner, I think it's much easier to get somebody to listen than, you know, maybe somebody like myself who doesn't have that background. Do you ever get in, I guess, ever have any backlash? And do you feel like maybe your scientific background helps with maybe getting these messages across?
I mean, I get a little backlash, but I'm small potatoes. So what's the point of anybody going after me, you know? So, I mean, maybe if my books become bestsellers, I might get more backlash. I don't know. Right now, I don't think anybody cares enough about what I say or don't say to bother lashing me back. Maybe that'll change. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But I don't know that it has anything to do with the so-called science of what I say. I describe things in a very particular way out of the way that I've, you know, taught myself to see the world. And that's all I can do. I mean, I just, and, you know, I have made a commitment really to myself to speak as clearly and as helpful in the communication as possible. Like, one thing I don't like, and a lot of people do this, it's like they're speaking or writing and they don't care if people actually understand what they're saying. And that just drives me crazy. because I want people to, or as I often jokingly say, I think, I may not know a lot, but what I know, I can definitely explain so anybody can understand it.
Well, that is really important, because I think sometimes it can kind of scare people off a little bit if it is too scientific and none of it seems to make sense to them. You know, I do the same thing if I try to explain to somebody the benefits of eating differently or whatever. I try to give them videos or podcasts or books that are easily to, you know, easy to digest and isn't, I guess, maybe too over the top with science mumbo jumbo, so it doesn't scare them off. But so for people listening, because we've kind of scratch the surface of some of these topics, what are some of the life changes in regards to like diet or I guess even lifestyle changes that you think could be beneficial to somebody listening that you think aren't utilized as much as they could be? Because what's your opinions on stuff like the paleo diet, the keto diet, the benefits of the fasting, stuff like that? Are you a fan of all those things?
Well, as far as diet, you know, I'm a founding member, board member of the Weston Price Foundation. And for those who don't know what that is, that's the dentist who went around the world looking for people with perfect teeth. And he found them, 14 groups all over the world, and they also had more or less perfect health. And then he said, if you want to have perfect health, you got to eat like these guys. I mean, that's probably as simple as you can get. And sometimes I put that in the context of, like, a while ago, there was a debate on the Joe Rogan show between a vegan cardiologist and a paleo guy, who I happen to know both of them.
Yeah, and Chris Kresser.
The vegan cardiologist did a great rendition in the beginning of how heart disease was almost absent, as was cancer, in 1920 in this country. Nobody had heart disease. They didn't even when they invented the EKG machine, they didn't think there was any use for it. And then in the 40s, things happened, and now we have everybody has heart disease. So to me, that debate should have ended then with the question, how many vegans were there in 1920? And the answer, I happen to know the exact answer, because it's zero, or at least zero by choice. So if he was correct, which I think he was, that there's basically no heart disease in 1920, and there was no vegans in 1920, and in fact the health foods were butter, fat, and eggs, how is it makes sense that the way to not have heart disease is for all of us to be vegans, right? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Same with cancer. Like, if, you know, doctors would go their whole career without seeing a single patient with breast cancer in 1920. It was rare. Now, I'm not saying it's all diet, because I don't think it is, but the fact of the matter is, all these people whose whole strategy with eating was to eat as much butter and cream and eggs as they could get their hands on, because they were scarce, really, they didn't get this disease. And so how is it possible that those foods cause the disease? Like, I don't care how many studies you can show me that show that that's the truth, because it can't possibly be. So anyways, when to answer your question, I'm a nourishing traditions guy. What does that mean? It means you eat the way people used to eat. They ate animal foods. They ate some sort of seed food, and they ate lots and lots of different vegetables and some fruits. That's the human diet. It gets reproduced over and over and over again all over the world.
Yeah, there's a great documentary called The Perfect Human Diet by C.J. Hunt. And first of all, before I forget, I think the debate you're talking about, is that the one with the Dr. Chris Kresser?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I love Dr. Kresser. He's awesome. I think people looking at functional medicine options is great that he's making it more popular and whatnot. But yeah, The Perfect Human Diet, they talk about Weston Price, and they talk about, basically they talk to historians and anthropologists and people in regards to like eating like our ancestors. And, you know, even Gary Tobbs talks about just a lack of sugar in our diet, and then how you can see the increase of obesity and all these other things as sugar becomes more apparent in our diets. And, you know, to me, it's mind blowing that what little time they spend in universities when becoming, you know, a doctor on diet and nutrition. And I mean, why do you think that is when it's quite obvious that it has a huge effect on our health?
Why?
Too big of a question.
They have a certain agenda and they do it. I mean, that's all there is to it. And the agenda is based on all kinds of, you know, interests and reasons, but they are, you know, they're obsessed in a sense. The whole medical system is obsessed with, you know, procedures and tests and pharmaceutical drugs. So that's what they teach.
Things that make them money.
Yeah. I mean, it's not totally that. It's in some ways a bigger issue than that. And you know, the other thing that's interesting about this obesity thing, because I've actually come to the conclusion that it's not just sugar. I'm not a fan of eating sugar, by the way, but, and you know, I mean, I've eaten a sort of nourishing tradition Weston Price diet for decades. But one of the interesting things that I couldn't help but pay attention to is, I don't know how old you are, but back in the 60s, there was a movie that came out called Fats Domino, which was about a very famous pool player. It's like a pool shark kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy who played Fats Domino in the movie was Jackie Gleason. Jackie Gleason was a famous comedian, and he was fat, so he played Fats Domino. He was also an expert pool player. So if you have a chance to watch the movie Fats Domino, or if you go to like and watch like old World Series films from 1960, and you see Jackie Gleason, if you put Jackie Gleason in Houston, Texas today, he would be in the 10 to 20% thinnest men in Houston, Texas. I mean, I would admit Jackie Gleason was a little bit overweight, but he wasn't really fat, at least not by today's standards. So what we're talking about is in 50 years, there has been an unbelievable change in the amount of obesity, even to the point where this one guy who was actually chosen for a movie role because he was so fat turns out to be almost like normal or on the thinnest side in 2020 in America. So what happened? Now, having grown up in the 50s and early 60s, I can tell you that it wasn't because we had a great diet then. Like, you know, we grew up eating processed food, sugar, and garbage. I mean, I grew up eating Twinkies and licorice. So it wasn't that, in fact, I would say to a certain extent, we eat less sugar now than we did in 1960. Not that we have a great diet, most Americans now, but that can't possibly be the reason, right? I mean, just doesn't make any sense. So what is the reason? I mean, I don't know. It's complicated, but I have a suspicion that actually, the single thing that's changed the most is exposure to wireless radiation.
Hmm.
And I also know that if you take a rat and you put a cell phone or a baby monitor next to the rat, it doesn't matter what you feed them, they'll get fat. And if you let them eat whatever they want, they will get even fatter because they'll eat horrible food. And so you can even figure out down to the details how exposure to non-native EMF radiation, you know, cell phones, baby monitors, tablets, on and on and on, routers, Wi-Fi, etc. Anybody who's exposed to that will have metabolic changes that lead to obesity and will affect their food choices. And even if they eat the same food as you did in 1960, like even if it's better food, you still end up getting fat. Now you can affect that to a certain extent by eating a ketogenic diet, eating a very low carb diet, and exercising and working out and fasting. And I do all those things. I like all those things. I write about them in my books. But I think there's a piece here that even most of the, you know, like holistic community, they're getting hipper now, but they haven't taken into account, and it's revealed by this, by just looking at what happened. We ate sugar in 1960 and we weren't fat. We eat sugar now and we're fat. I'm not saying sugar's good. Don't misunderstand me. But it wasn't the whole story. And there's some other possible culprits like glyphosate. We didn't have glyphosate in the United States in 1960. Glyphosate interferes with your barriers and probably makes you fat.
Yeah. What would be the explanation on, you know, people in Europe, you would assume are basically exposed to the same type of radio frequencies and cell phones and Wi-Fi and all that stuff as we are here, but yet they're thinner. So how would you explain that? Is it just really just a lack of, less exercise here or less walking or something like that? Lifestyle changes or differences, I should say?
Yeah, they also the Europe one, it is very interesting because I think it isn't just wireless radiation. I think it's somehow the combination of that and glyphosate, because over the years I've had I don't know how many, probably 100 patients who say if they eat wheat in America, in the United States, they feel sick. They go to Italy, they eat the same type of wheat, like Durum wheat, and they're fine.
Yeah, they're not as there's people who, same thing with pastas and stuff like that. They're easier to digest.
Yeah, in Europe.
Yep.
And maybe there isn't less cell phone radiation, but they don't in the United States, the commercial wheat is all soaked in glyphosate. And in Europe they don't use it. So maybe that's the difference.
Yeah, and also I think
it's a combination of those two, and there's probably other factors that are the point is it's got to be more of a global factor than just you're dumb and you eat the wrong food, because it's almost a universal phenomenon these days. But it's true, there's something different in Europe that they haven't done yet that's contributing to this obesity thing.
Well, this was a long time ago, but I believe I remember reading a study in regards to people in Europe and people in America being on the same diet in regards to how many calories they're intaking, how many calories they're burning at the gym, and people in Europe were losing weight at a much quicker rate. And then they basically came to the conclusion that it wasn't because they were both eating the same 1 pound of meat or whatever it may be, but it was the quality of the meat that was having an effect on their weight loss. And so absolutely, I think that when you look at a grass-fed beef compared to, you know, some green slime-filled burger from, you know, Mickey D's or whatnot, I think it's not the same thing, even though, you know, we just like to call it all just ground meat. It's just burger, you know, it's just a burger, but it's not the same thing. So, yeah, without a doubt,
right,
quality of what you're eating is almost equal as important as what you're eating. You know, I think people sometimes overlook that, you know, I'm eating a good diet, but it's like, what's the quality of food you're getting? I know you're big in gardening. Like I mentioned, like I was born in Portugal, in northern Portugal, on a farm, and my parents are, you know, when they came to America, they kind of kept up a lot of those traditional stuff of growing your own food and raising, you know, goats and chickens and all that stuff. So I have the benefit of getting some of that stuff from my parents. And you do see that these people who live in these, you know, just poor areas in Portugal, grew up on farms, they live till they're pretty old and they work their ass off their whole lives. You know, they're kind of labor intensive jobs. And you know, I think quality of food and quality of life, because I think one thing to take in consideration when coming to I live in the East Coast in Massachusetts, coming to the East Coast of America, how fast-paced and stressful life is. I without a doubt it has an effect on, you know, your longevity and on your health, without a doubt. So I think just looking back at our ancestors, like you said, not just on the way they ate, but the way they lived, I think we can learn a lot from that. I'm a big fan of Dr. Christopher Ryan's, and he just released a book called Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. And I love the argument that he's making in that book. And what the hell do we consider progress? And we need to rethink what is progress. Yeah, we have phones that cell phones, and we have cars that drive fast, and we have all this stuff, but we're less happy, we're less healthy. And so we need to kind of rethink what is progress. And I think that's something that people don't really take in consideration. They think that, oh yeah, we're better off in America than we are in sometimes the old country we came from, because we have more material things, we have more ones and zeros in our bank account, but we're not happier and we're not healthier. So, you know, we might have to take some steps back and learn from our ancestors. And like you said, you know, Socrates said plenty of quotes that I think make sense today to a lot of people, like, you know, let food be thy medicine and all these things. It's like we get so far, we learn things, and then we think we're progressing, and then we look back and we're like, you know what, they probably had it right. So I think, yeah. You know, we definitely...
Yeah, there's a lot of factors, but definitely, you know, as my friend Derek Jensen wrote in his title of his book, where the culture of make-believe. And we make-believe that all these things are good when really they're just making life more miserable for us.
Yeah, and in some cases, I don't think, you know, I've talked about Big Pharma a lot on this show. I mean, obviously, there's just a huge market in selling kids vaccines, and I mean, there's tons of profit in it, especially when you have a vaccine court and you're not liable for your product sucking or injuring somebody. But it's not, it might not all be just money motivated. I think in some cases it is just people thinking that, oh yeah, this is a better thing. You know, having faster internet, having Wi-Fi is a better thing. But like you talked about, you know, it could have some negative effects on even weight gain, and who knows what other type of health effects it could cause that we're not quite sure of yet, because it's all new stuff and we haven't had enough time, and the world is evolving so quickly, we haven't had enough time to kind of see what type of health effects or negative effects it might cause. I mean, there are people who talk about the 5G thing, there's people who talk about, you know, not having any Wi-Fi or anything on at night, and they sleep better, and you know, their better moods and all this stuff. So there is something there. So I think all those things are super important. You know, I have a couple of kids, and I have two a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they're unvaccinated, and you know, they're healthy. We try to give them, you know, probiotics, vitamins. We try to eat as organic as we can, and they're healthy as hell, and they don't have any allergies. They don't have any medical, I mean, knock on wood, we've had zero medical issues. You know, hopefully it stays that way. And I love this way of thinking, of just kind of, I guess, trying to live as much like our primitive ancestors as possible. And yeah, that, you know, so
good. I think we've got somewhere here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I've already taken up a bunch of your time, so I don't want to hold you up any longer. But thank you so much, Dr. Cowan. Well, Tom, because I know you like to be called Tom. You don't like Thomas. And thanks for your time, and keep up the great work. And hopefully have you on again in the near future.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yep.
Bye bye. I believe in the ripple effect.